Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 30th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I am still on my staycation because we didn't want to go to the beach to watch how the waves would sweep away our child. But just because my vacation was ruined and the brief, just few days that I get where I can disconnect from the surge of the news doesn't mean that you're not going to get some great content today. On the program, Dahlia Lithwick of Slate.com talking about the Republican attacks on the National Labor Relations Board, followed by Greg Mitchell of the Nation magazine to talk to us about his latest book, which details the cover-up and the, I guess, subjugation of color footage film that was taken by the military of the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki so that Americans couldn't see how horrible the devastation was. So those two interviews, enjoy them today. And again, folks, 33 cents a day. That's how much it costs to make sure that this show continues. 33 cents a day. Somebody email me, one of you freeloaders, and tell me, what can you buy with 33 cents a day? Okay, well, I'm going to give some time for that to come in. I guess I can't anticipate it now because it's pre-taped. And if you want to support the show in other ways, because you're just one of those people who are whistling past the graveyard in terms of supporting this show directly as a member, you can buy your junk through our Amazon link at Majority FM. You can buy the best tasting coffee, tea, or chocolate you've ever had. And not only is it great tasting when you buy coffee from the justcoffee.coop, you feel good about yourself. Why? Because you're supporting a fair trade of policies, you're supporting a co-op business, and you're getting 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY, and I get a little bit of kickback on that, so don't hesitate. And of course, donateyouraccount.com/MAJORITYFM, donate your Facebook account, let us post one thing a day. You will not be embarrassed by this stuff. You're going to feel proud about it. You would have done it anyways if you weren't so lazy. But this way we make it easy for you to get all those likes and have all your friends go, my gosh, what's going on with that guy or gal? They certainly seem to be a little bit more plugged in than I seem to remember. When that guy was doing 11-foot beer bong hits in college, I never imagined that he would be spreading this type of interesting information. Or when that young lady was talking about her career in fashion, I never thought, when she was talking about being a hand model for JCPenney, I never thought that she thought about such deep things, was so politically in touch. I'm going to give them a like on Facebook. See, folks, see how your life can change, how much better it can be. Now, enjoy these two interviews with Dahlia Lithwick and Greg Mitchell. I will be, I believe, live on Thursday, perhaps. Maybe not. We have a great interview for you anyways. And tomorrow, don't miss an interview I did with Chris Hayes last week and Abe Sauer from The All on the Tea Party. Okay, on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Dahlia Lithwick. She is a senior editor at Slate Online Magazine, as well as their legal editor correspondent.
That's good. That
I'm
works.
Handing out any type of titles that you want.
6 foot blonde.
There you go. And so, Dahlia, I saw this piece you wrote a couple of weeks ago on what's happening with the National Labor Relations Board, and this is a topic that has been going on for a while, specifically in terms of the way that it deals with Boeing. Just tell us the broad outlines of this story. In how it relates. First, just tell us the broad outlines.
Well, it's really a story about the NLRB, which is longstanding federal agency, independent federal agency that's tasked with protecting workers' rights, and it's been a lightning rod for a long time. It's been almost impossible to fill seats on the board. It's always been a bit of a political football. But things have gone kind of crazy with this new Congress.
And we should just say that this is the National Labor Relations Board. It's a statutory authority, I think, comes from like 1933. I mean, so this isn't a recent phenomena that Obama has put in as part of his communist plot.
Right. No, this is created by the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. It's a longstanding agency. It has some functions that are investigative, some that are adjudicatory, but certainly there's an elaborate statutory system in place that makes this thing run. It's not Obama's lapdog, although I think it's been portrayed as that. And essentially, we've got a conflict now that stems from a fight about Boeing. So Boeing apparently moved some of its operations out of Washington State, which is a union-friendly state, down to South Carolina, which labels itself a right-to-work state. And in right-to-work state, it's much harder to force someone as a condition of employment to pay dues or fees to a union, even though they may benefit from unions and collective bargaining. So they move their operations, and it's not at all in question, I don't think, Sam, that they move it because there've been strikes in Washington, and it's annoying and it's hampering Boeing. Now the problem is,
well, I think it was Boeing's CEO or his number two that basically said we're moving it because we have problems with our strikes.
I mean, exactly. He says it on video. I've got a link in the piece where he tells the Seattle Times on video this is why we relocated. Now under the National Labor Relations Act, that's just illegal. And so the NLRB begins an investigation. There is an adjudicatory proceeding to try to figure out what happened and if what happened broke the law. And in the midst of this, Congress starts just papering them with subpoenas. And oversight of the NLRB turns into this attempt to make it absolutely impossible to investigate what happened with Boeing in Washington. There's a judicial proceeding that's underway that cannot function because they're being absolutely, the NLRB, I should say, is being having these ridiculous demands to produce by congressional subpoena power every document that has anything to do with anything in the case.
And so, we have the situation where the NLRB makes this decision and then it gets sent to a judge, and is adjudicated. Now, my understanding is that there were at least almost a half a dozen cases under the Bush National Labor Relations Board that were overturned by the courts. So it's certainly not a process that is, and of course, the makeup of the board was different at that time. Now it's, I think it's 3-2 Democrats or 5-4. I'm not exactly sure, but. So this is not a process that is always exact in terms of the law, but it's not set up to be that way. It is – that's what the courts are for.
Well, that's the really critical piece of this, and it's easy to get bogged down in he says, she says, but the critical piece of this is that this is a judicial function. This is an agency, an independent federal agency, that has a judicial process in place to do the fact-finding that has to happen. And that starts, and it goes on, and it ended, and it ends. And it hasn't ended yet. It's only just begun. But rather than let this judicial officer do his job, rather than letting the judicial process play out, congressional Republicans are making it literally impossible to go forward with the judicial process. And I want to be also very clear that Darrell Issa has said in no uncertain terms he would happily close the whole NLRB down if they don't do what he wants. I mean, they've tried in Congress to defund the NLRB almost completely, almost out of existence. So I think it's just you have to see this as a real war on the whole agency, an attempt to force the agency to stop doing what its core function is, which is to determine have the rights of workers been violated by Boeing. And the idea that you know, and what congressional representatives say as they continue to paper them to death and to demand more and more documents is, oh, we don't have time to let this judicial function work its way through. We've got to do this right here, right now. We're in an economic crisis. And what that does is disserve the sort of fundamental promise of a judicial process, which is, of course we have time. We don't make decisions before judges have come to a conclusion that the judge is corrupt and the agency is corrupt and the prosecution is a witch hunt. We let the thing play out. There are things to do after. If Boeing doesn't prevail and congressional Republicans are horrified, they have remedies. But just to end this before it begins, that's really what is shocking about this particular controversy.
Do you think they're doing this? I mean, do you think they're doing this just purely for political points? I mean, not and. I don't mean to imply that there's anything that they do that isn't for political points, but you know, I was on Kudlow like I don't know 3-4 months ago to talk about this, and nobody on the panel seemed to take it seriously, even though that they were arguing that this was unprecedented and whatnot. They, you know, after the segment, all of them. You can, for obvious reasons, I didn't necessarily fit in with the crowd. They were talking like this will get overturned by the judiciary, and they're quite confident of it. So it seems to me that I have no sense of whether it would be overturned or not, but it seems to me to be completely theatrical. Just that it is, or do they actually really want to take out the National Labor Relations Board, or are they trying to intimidate them for the future? What do you think their end game is, or is it just like, let's just see how much of this sticks?
Well, a couple of responses, and I'll try to be quick. One is just as a pragmatic point, there's case law that says that Congress, when it intervenes so zealously in the running of an independent agency, can actually scuttle a judicial process. So there's a weird way in which, by doing what they're doing, this doesn't just sort of get in the way of this Boeing case. Actually, the end result of the Boeing case can be overturned by a court down the road because of what Congress has done. So that's one piece of it. It's kind of fascinating to see this isn't just trying to get in the way. This is really going to affect the ultimate outcome here. But I think to your larger question, it's very, very clear that this is part of just a larger war on unions, right? This is something that is going on in Wisconsin. This is the key to the fighting that we've seen all around the country about unions, is this idea that they're evil, that union workers are all lazy and they make unreasonable demands, and that particularly in an economy where jobs matter, the Republicans are trying to get people to work and unions are just being fat cats who are looking out for their own interests. So I think it dovetails with that rhetoric. One thing that's really been interesting to me, Sam, is just going out and talking about this. Even though the media isn't paying a ton of attention to this, people on the ground care a lot about this. I've been really, really interested to see how much just Americans and progressives know about this story. They actually know more about it than I did because they've been following it for some time. And I think just the last point I would make, and this is so important, in my piece I link to a Harold Meyerson column where he makes the incredibly important point. This isn't just about unions and union busting. This is about running off Democratic voters. And I quote him saying, and I think this is so true, unions remain the most effective part of the Democratic coalition in turning out minority voters come election time and getting working class whites to vote for Democrats. So I think one of the things you want to really think about as you think about this is that it's not just about doing away with the work of unions and workers' rights. It's about unions as a get out it's about unions as a get out the vote machine that has been incredibly effective. And the best way to scuttle that kind of get out the vote effort is to really, really scuttle unions. And so I think that is also a piece of this. It seems so cynical, but I really think it's worth thinking about if you can, you know, completely discredit and defang unions in this country. It's one more way to make sure that folks aren't voting for Democrats in the next election.
Yeah, well, I mean, Republicans are quite good, I think, at this type of twofer stuff. I mean, it's the reason why they took out Acorn. It's the reason why they demonize trial lawyers, because not only are trial lawyers prevent the excesses of corporations, they also fund Democrats because Democrats are not attacking them and Republicans are. And so that's a twofer for Republicans. But getting back to the case, we have a situation where where Boeing promised Seattle that they would build, I think it's the 707 or 727, one of the planes in this Seattle outfit. They moved it because they wanted to avoid, in their words, the potential for labor strikes. They bribed officials in North Carolina so much so that they had to return the money, is my understanding, in terms of setting up their factory there. And the NLRB is basically saying that they must keep their company, their factory, in Washington State. Is this – how unprecedented is it and for the National Labor Relations to make this the remedy? And what else could be the remedy?
Well, my understanding is that nothing – no outcome here forces the closure of the plant in South Carolina. So the idea that, oh, we're going to take away all these jobs out of South Carolina, that's not going to happen, I don't think, under any set of facts. It's just rhetoric. So I think one of the things that the NLRB points out in their legal pleadings is that there is lots and lots and lots of precedent for the NLRB to take action against companies that move facilities or even threaten to move their facilities because of strikes. It's absolutely illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. And even though you'll hear congressional Republicans say over and over again, nothing like this has ever been done. Nothing like this has ever been done. It's been done a lot because it's illegal. And again, this is early days in this judicial proceeding. We don't know yet what the court will find or might have found, barring having this entire case blow up because of the, quote, oversight that has turned into, you know, deranged meddling. But we don't know what the judge would find out, and we may never get to know. But it's really important to understand all we have now are pleadings and the early stages of litigation, and what's happening now is going to absolutely immobilize that process so that we don't get to find out what might have happened down the road. And that's why the issue here isn't just Boeing or isn't just organized labor or isn't just congressional oversight. It's thwarting due process, fundamental notions of due process and judicial process. That's what's really being disrupted here, and that's why this is really shocking.
And so we have a situation where Congress is not only impeding the executive branch, but they're also impeding the judiciary branch.
that's the really important takeaway for me, is that to act as though we can't wait for this legal process to play out because it will take so long. That's a justification for scuttling every trial, every judicial proceeding in America. That is not what we do in this country. Let it play out, see what the judge determines, and then be outraged. But to be outraged simply because the NLRB is doing what it always does and has always done, this time with regard to Boeing, that is really, really terrifying.
Is there any support for this process coming from any other quarters? Or do we just simply have one entity, the Republicans in Congress, who are doing everything they can to thwart this process, to poison the well, to make it almost impossible to adjudicate, and there's no pushback from any other quarters?
Well, you know, there was a really interesting letter. Again, I linked to it in my piece. It's worth looking at, from 34 legal experts who are experts in labor law, who wrote a letter to Congressman Issa and said, look, please, 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 you know, you cannot demand, quote, all documents and communications relating to this case without imperiling the whole case. And please understand, oversight is oversight, but other congressional committees, they say, routinely manage to carry out their functions without intruding into active cases, end quote. So there has been a little bit of pushback, but I think it seems to me that this is one of those issues that has largely fallen off the radar, because in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't seem all that important. One of the reasons I wrote about it, Sam, is I think in the grand scheme of things, it's complicated, but it is all that important and more. And I think it goes to this deep, deep congressional suspicion, or suspicion on the part of congressional Republicans, of every single government agency. And so it's not just the NLRB. You know, you're hearing calls for closing down so many different government agencies. We've completely stalled judicial appointments. It seems that every single answer to these questions is less government is better, and if that means completely dismantling one government agency after another, all the better. And that really is something that I don't think there's been a lot of pushback from the left. The argument that, you know what, government isn't the problem here, particularly when this is a government agency that is trying to protect labor.
And people can read that piece at slate.com. Dahlia Lithwick, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I turned my camera on. I cut my fingers on the way. On the way. The way I'm slipping away. I turned my feelings on. You made me untouchable for life. Yeah, yeah. And you wasn't the light. It hit me.
So I'd like to welcome to the show, his umpteenth time, perhaps, Greg Mitchell. His new book, Atomic Cover-Up, is out now. Atomic Cover-Up, Two U.S. Soldiers, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the Greatest Movie Never Made. And, of course, Greg can be found at the Nation magazine at nation.com. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Hi, very happy to be here.
All right, so Greg, first tell us the story that you cover in the book. It's pretty stunning. I mean, I've watched the promo for the book, and the images themselves are pretty stunning stuff.
Well, it's kind of one of a kind book that I've sort of 30 years in the making. I first wrote about this back when I was the editor of Nuclear Times magazine in the 1980s, and I've done a great deal of research since then, including at the Truman Library. And it basically tells the story of the reason I call it Atomic Cover-Up is it's the suppression for decades of all of the film footage that was taken in Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the atomic bombings, the first months after. And the book concentrates on the color footage shot by the U.S. military, by an elite team that was sent there to record the aftermath. But it also covers, in a secondary way, the U.S. seizing all of the footage, black and white footage, shot by Japanese newsreel teams, and also suppressing that for decades. But the main story is about the American military team who shot this footage, and then despite the efforts by two of the leaders to try to get the footage released, to try to make movies about it or have people around the world see the images, they were rebuffed. The film was kept secret for many decades, and I think, you know, we can talk about this later with really ill effects for the future of the U.S. post-war, the nuclear arms race, and the whole nuclear entrapment since then.
Now, the reasons why the U.S. military would suppress this probably, or at least on first glance, wouldn't be surprising to me. But what was their agenda when they sent over this team of filmmakers?
Well, they were sent over to merely record the damage to buildings, bridges, and other structures. And when they got to Nagasaki, they were, you know, so appalled by the effects on people, which the U.S. didn't much care about. And so they shot a great deal of footage of you know, of the victims of the bomb and the struggles to survive, the hazards of radiation disease and other radiation effects, bizarre burns, and other horrible things that came from uniquely from this type of weapon. And at the time, you might say, what's the big deal? People knew that a lot of people died there, which is true. People knew that there was some radiation effect. It's also true. But this footage, was shot in color, which hardly anyone saw at the time. And we were suppressing all images of the aftermath of the bomb, except for, what we all saw back then in the 40s and 50s and 60s, sort of the recurring images of the black and white, the mushroom cloud, the sort of devastated landscape, the A-bomb dome, the buildings that was collapsed and things like that. But you think back, probably in this, listeners right now, try to think of how many color images you've seen. How many, especially film footage. How many images have you really seen? Especially in color of the victims and what happened to them. It was really hidden for many decades. And as for the question about why we did it, there'd be several reasons. One would be we were in the middle of a nuclear arms race. We wanted to build new weapons. We wanted to build the hydrogen bomb. We wanted to, keep ahead of the Russians. So we certainly didn't want anything getting in the way of that. Second, we didn't want to focus on what was new about this weapon, which was the radiation effects. Third, we were in the midst of a big civil defense drive to convince Americans that they could survive a nuclear war. We had duck and cover in schools. We had fault shelters in basements. So we didn't want anything that really showed the full extent of the, of this new bomb to sort of trick people into thinking it was survivable. And then the fourth thing would be we had, and this is sort of an important point in the book, the U.S. still has a first use policy. It's maintained a first use policy to this day. And so here was the first use of the bomb, and we wanted to retain the policy of being able to use the bomb again. And then the final reason might be that we'd never admit it, but maybe some of our leaders did feel a little guilty about using the bomb.
It's interesting because the U.S. military, at least, was conscious of the power of those images at that time. I mean, there's a strong argument that the images that we saw, the color images on television that we saw of the Vietnam War, went a long way in creating some dissent amongst the American public. I mean, obviously, yeah. To see this stuff up front, it humanizes the victims. I mean, that's ultimately what it comes down to, right?
Well, I would recommend anyone listening now, if you want, when you get a chance, go to YouTube. If you want, you mentioned the promo for the film. It's just a 2-minute kind of trailer, but it includes some of the suppressed footage. So if you go there, if you just search for Atomic Cover-Up, which is the name of the book, but also you can find that as a search term at YouTube, and it'll come up right away. It's become a very popular trailer, and you'll be able to see some of the suppressed footage and sort of judge for yourself if this was if this type of footage might have made a big difference many years ago.
Yeah, we'll put that on our website as well at Majority FM. And but how did this footage? I mean, were people widely aware that this footage existed? Was this footage sort of lost? How did it? How was it found?
Well, as I said, it was completely suppressed by the government. It became known in the late 1970s in a chance meeting between one of the two men. You know, the subtitle of my book is about the two soldiers who tried to get the film released. Well, one of them happened to meet a Japanese anti-nuclear activist and mentioned that he had shot this footage. And lo and behold, the footage had just been declassified and at the National Archives. No one knew about it. So, I mean, it had been declassified for a few years, and no one knew it existed. So as people told me, it was just as good as it had never been declassified. In fact, we might never even know about it now, except for a few chance encounters. So it sat in the National Archives. So then the Japanese filmmakers started using it, and then eventually American filmmakers started using it in snippets. You know, there hasn't been a full movie made using it, or you know, for more than a few minutes. So,
isn't that weird?
I closed my book by saying we're still awaiting a full film about it. We could talk about also this MGM film that was made back at the same time this footage was being suppressed. But you know, this footage itself has not been used in a complete film.
Yeah, I want to talk about that MGM thing. But I mean, it's strange to me that no documentarian has gone down there and looked at this footage and said, "I'm compelled to make a film about this." I mean, why do you think that might be? I mean, it's hard to find topics that are not covered in a documentary, and this seems to be a rather prominent one. And you know, knowing having some experience in that documentary world, to have access to that type of footage is, you know, one of the key building blocks of making a film like that.
Well, there's hours and hours and hours of. I mean, I have most of it on VHS tape. I've copied, but I haven't made a film about it yet. Like I said, people have used a few minutes of it here and there, a few seconds of it. So it's not secret anymore. And actually, I was in the first article at Nuclear Times in 1983 that I produced. Really was what informed Americans about the footage. So since that article, like I said, it has been used in various documentaries, but not in a major way yet.
But I mean, do you think there's something cultural? I mean, that is, or do you think that this says something about our relationship with the bomb, with the nuclear weapon? That maybe because you know, we have sort of gone to sleep about this issue because we don't have at least the perception that there's a threat like we had a perception when there was a Soviet Union, or is it something that just, you know, culturally speaking, this is something that we just don't think about anymore?
Yeah, well, a lot has changed. Back in the 1980s, we had a big anti-nuclear weapons movement in the U.S. I mean, the issue has come and gone. Since the end of the Cold War, there's less fear of a superpower exchange, you know. At the same time, there's been, you know, rising fears about the terrorist bomb, about a dirty bomb, about smuggled nuclear materials, but it doesn't get nearly as much attention as we used to get kind of the daily fear about the Soviets. So some people are properly concerned about, you know, about all those extra threats, proliferation, accidental nuclear war. I mean, we could go on and on about the reasons people should be concerned about the bomb. And they're not. And, you know, people ask me, why do I keep writing about Hiroshima? I mean, I did a previous book with Robert J. Lifton called Hiroshima in America, which was had quite a big impact. And I've basically written about the subject for 30 years. And, you know, the reason, you know, one of the reasons is certainly that that the U.S. still has a first use policy. And every year in August, the media and policymakers almost always defend the use of the bomb in 1945 while also saying never again. But, you know, there's a complete contradiction there because we, you know, the more we defend the two times we did use the bomb makes it more likely we might use it again because, you know, we've already made an exception or two exceptions. And, you know, the same similar circumstances could come up where, we want to shorten a war or another, we want to save American lives or whatever. So that's what worries me about continuing to defend the use of the bomb in 1945.
Let's talk about that before we get to the MGM. Before we started this interview, I had mentioned to you this piece that I had read in The Globe about this Toshiya Oshii Hasegawa, forgive me for butchering that, and he's got a theory that is one that I had never heard before that I'm sure you're familiar with about give us the three different perspectives. I mean, there are three different perspectives on the implication. As far as I can tell, there are three. Maybe there's more. Three major implications or perceptions of what the implications of the bomb were, ranging from it was the only way we could end that war, to the war would have ended anyways, to this third, where the war ended and it had really not so much to do with the dropping of these bombs.
Right, right. Well, of course, this is a two-hour discussion, so one hates to be too sketchy about it, but, you know, there have been many, many reputable historians now for decades that have argued that with a good deal of evidence, and there is evidence on the other side as well, that the use of the bomb was not necessary. I mean, there, of course, is the moral argument that it never should have been used. You know, the bomb was targeted to kill hundreds of thousands of civilians, which it did. And so there's the argument that should never be done under any circumstance. But even putting that aside, the question of was it necessary to end the war at that time period? And there's a lot of evidence that the Japanese would have surrendered in a few days because of the Russians entering the war on August 7th as planned, not because they wanted to get in on the kill. We had urged them to join the war earlier, and Truman had even written in his diary, "Finny Japs," when that occurs. So there's no proof that the Japanese would have surrendered quickly after the Russians entered the war, but it is quite possible. As we know, Japan was near collapse at the time. They could have held out for quite a few weeks. We really don't know. So there are those who say that using the bomb, well, we know what happened. We know they did, for whatever reason, the Japanese surrendered a few days later, whether it was because of the Russians or whatever, we don't know. But so we don't want to go back and redo that and hope that, you know, we don't use the bomb and they still surrender. So that's basically what the debate, the debate is over, whether the bomb was really necessary.
Right. And I guess this third theory takes it even further insofar as it wasn't, they did not surrender because of the bomb, that it wasn't till later, like you say, when the Russians declared their intent to attack Japan rather than function as the Japanese, you know, the theory holds that the Japanese wanted them to function, which was a mediator. They thought they could get a better deal if they dealt with the Russians while the Russians were not involved in the conflict.
Yeah. They had already been dealing with the Russians. That had been going on for a few weeks. They were already using Russia to peace feelers, and they were surprised when the Russians then said, "No, we're going to declare war on you," and in fact started attacking them. So that's you know, that's part of that. The other, just briefly, the other thing is that, you know, we had demanded unconditional surrender, which the Japanese rejected. But then after, you know, they signaled after using the bomb, we then said, oh, by the way, you can keep your emperor, which would have been a big stumbling block. So to some people, it seems like we demanded unconditional surrender until we used the bomb, and then we sort of made it conditional. So a little suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, it suggests on some level that we wanted to show that the bomb was the deciding factor, is sort of in some way of our justification for usage of it.
Right. There's a lot, you know, I don't take one, I mean, there are some people who take one sort of certain path, you know, one view of this. You know, I don't. I think it's very complicated. I think there's a lot of reasons we wanted to use the bomb. You know, some people say we just wanted to use the bomb to warn the Russians and scare mm-hmm. them from... Scare them from having an arms race and get them out of Eastern Europe and everything else. I think that may have been part of it, but I don't think that's the only reason. Some people say we only used it to justify the $2 billion we spent. I think that was part of it, but I don't think that's the only reason. We can go through eight different reasons, and I don't think any of them alone really accounts for it.
And so let's go back and tell me about the Hollywood's involvement in covering up this footage.
Right. Well, it's sort of a, I wouldn't say amusing, but it is a kind of a wild and wacky sidelight to all this. You know, part of the atomic cover-up. Again, just very briefly, when the war ended, the atomic scientists who did feel a little guilty about making the bomb. Proposed to MGM a blockbuster movie about making the bomb, which would serve as a warning for future uses of atomic energy and would also raise questions about dropping the bomb. And I guess surprisingly, MGM and Louis B. Mayer and so forth went along with this and promoted it as as their next great movie. But unfortunately, they gave script approval to the Pentagon and to the White House, and so the movie started as this kind of anti-nuclear script and ended up, after the Pentagon and the White House got through with it, 180 degrees in the opposite direction, glorifying nuclear energy and endorsing the use of the bomb. And Truman himself even got the actor who played him in the movie fired and replaced by another actor who would portray him in a more sympathetic manner. So it's, Ayn Rand did a script, one of the original scripts for it. I mean, it's in the book. It's sort of a great sidelight. But I guess the point and the reason it's in this book is that this was going on at the exact same time in the late 1940s that this color footage, that's the real focus of the book, was being suppressed. So it kind of goes hand in hand.
And what's the lesson? I mean, at the end of the day, what is the lesson that we're learning about that this whole episode teaches us in terms of our perspective on the government, I guess, and the bomb itself?
Well, the bomb itself, I wrote a piece for The Nation this week called From Hiroshima to Fukushima, and I think this pattern of cover-up and suppression that began there, really in the first moments of the nuclear age, has continued. And I mean, you know, again, we could go on and on with all the dangers and threats and the millions of Americans who have been potentially harmed by the nuclear era, whether it's soldiers who were subjected to nuclear tests, to workers in nuclear plants, all of us growing up in the 50s and 60s who were subjected to fallout in the atmosphere, strontium-90 in our milk, on and on and on. And I guess the point of the book is this suppression of evidence that Americans should have was denied from the beginning and then continued on and on and on to this day. And, of course, we see it in Japan now with the Fukushima, with the people there charging cover-up and people there not told about the real dangers and everything else. So there certainly are sort of profound echoes today. So I think the book is actually quite relevant to today.
It is Atomic Cover-Up, two U.S. soldiers, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the greatest movie never made. We will link to it on Majority.fm, as well as the trailer that has some of that color footage that was covered up for so many years. And, of course, you can always check out Greg Mitchell at Nation.com to read about this and other stories. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Sam, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.